This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The women's marches of 2017 and 18 are part of a long tradition of women demonstrating in Washington, D.C. It's a tradition that started in 1913. Suffragists marched on Washington for the first time that year. In fact, they were among the very first people ever to march in the nation's capital. They were protesting to give women the right to vote, a right that did not come until 1920. Rebecca Roberts wrote about the first women's march in her new book, Suffragists in Washington, D.C., the 1913 Parade and the Fight for the Vote. She's a former journalist who's currently the program coordinator for Smithsonian Associates, which is a museum-based education program. Rebecca Roberts, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to write this book.
Well, the parallels are sort of hard to ignore, right? I mean, this was a march of women right down the corridors of federal power in Washington, designed to coordinate with the inauguration of a president they hadn't voted for in order to announce that women's voices were here to stay and wouldn't be silenced and that the incoming administration needed to pay attention, which all sounds awfully familiar from January 2017. So when everybody was planning that march, I thought, I've heard this before. We are not the first to come up with this idea. And my book about the 1913 march was born. It was quite a production, though. It was a much more organized, much more beautiful, much more coordinated program than the marches of a year ago.
Well, and what is significant about that is, as you say, we're quite familiar now with these organized marches on Washington, D.C. Not so much then. There had just been a couple of marches in the late 19th century owing to unemployment, et cetera. But this was really the first massive march of its kind and a very unlikely kind of demonstration for women in 1913.
Shocking, really. And it was shocking to speak your mind in public in 1913, you know, as a woman. That was something nice girls just didn't do. And the idea of parading, quite literally, down Pennsylvania Avenue, it was a fairly aggressive statement, not just that women were sort of here to stay and don't ignore them, but it was also an announcement of a new push for a federal amendment to enfranchise women. The suffrage movement had been concentrating more on this very slow, steady, plodding state-by-state strategy, which was kind of sort of working, but was also really expensive and a really long haul and really hard to inspire women to join. And so this march was not only something that women could really enjoy and feel like they were participating in, but it was the announcement of a new political strategy, which is what ultimately mattered for the 19th Amendment getting passed.
Tell us about the chief strategist and the chief organizer, Alice Paul.
Alice Paul, her story is getting better known, and I think as we lead up to the centennial of the 19th Amendment, we're going to be hearing a whole lot about Alice Paul. She was raised Quaker and kind of sort of agreed with equality in a theoretical sense, but she hadn't been involved in the American suffrage movement as a young person. And then she went to England for grad school, and she heard Emmeline Pankhurst speak. And Emmeline Pankhurst, now, you know, England also had their sort of color within the line, slow and steady suffrage movement. But they had this more radical wing led by Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters. And no matter how militant the Alice Paul American wing got, they had nothing on those British suffragists. I mean, they were setting stuff on fire. So it was a completely whole different level of guerrilla tactics. And Alice Paul was sort of radicalized by the Pankhurst wing of the British suffragist movement. By the way, suffragette, British, suffragist, American. That's the difference between those
Thank
two
words. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So Alice Paul went to jail. She went on a hunger strike. She was force-fed. By the time she came back to the U.S. in 1910, she was wondering why the American movement was so slow and so boring.
She hits on the idea of this march, this parade. Tell us about the organization, because she really stood her ground when it came to organizing, getting the permits. I mean, as you say, this is not done. So she had to work very hard, not only to organize, but just to get permission for this thing the way she wanted it.
She really wanted Pennsylvania Avenue. She wanted the symbolism of marching from the Capitol to the White House. She wanted to march where the men march. Most people, I'm sure, have seen those Matthew Brady photographs of, like, the Army of the Potomac parading down Pennsylvania Avenue. It's where celebratory military parades happened. So she wanted to be there. And the chief of police was not crazy about that idea at all. Not only was it hard to permit because the inauguration was going to be the next day, but also that's where all the saloons in town were. He was really worried that misbehaving men would interrupt the parade. He kept trying to offer her alternate routes. You know, how about 16th Street? How about this? How about that? And she didn't want safe. She wanted to march where the men marched. And then the logistics of getting all these women to town in a, you know, pre-email age, right, and organizing all of the costumes and all of the pageantry, because it all looked incredible. It was meant to look incredible in the photographs in the newspapers the next day. So every single color and detail was planned out.
Well, let's talk about this one detail. You mentioned it, but let's highlight it. She wanted it the day before Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. So yep, there were going to be a lot of people in town ready to party anyway. And she wanted to make that point. I'm marching down the same street that he'll be, that the president's going to walk down tomorrow.
And that is, of course, what happened. All of these men who were in town for Wilson's inauguration showed up to watch the suffrage parade the day before, kind of as a sideshow. They weren't particularly there because they were interested in suffrage. And they behaved very badly. They blocked the parade route. The pictures are extraordinary. Pennsylvania Avenue is a really broad street. And the men were just shoulder to shoulder. There's not daylight between them. Blocking the parade route, they yelled at the women. They spit on the women. They tripped the women. And they made it impossible for the march to proceed.
I was going to ask you, forgive me for interrupting, but certainly the women in that march and the organizers were prepared for some kind of pushback. Did they realize or have any sense that it would be as bad as it was?
I don't think so. What they were doing was shocking enough that they weren't naive enough to think that everyone would just cheer them on and nothing would happen. In fact, they wanted to provoke a reaction. Otherwise, they wouldn't have insisted on Pennsylvania Avenue. But I think they underestimated how enormous the crowds would be, how effective the crowds would be at physically blocking the road, and also how useless the police were. The police not only didn't control the crowd, in some cases they joined in the jeering and the taunting and the swearing. And so they were really totally thwarted until they literally called in the cavalry, which goes to show you they did expect trouble, right? The women did have these federal mounted troops standing by to come in and ride their horses into the crowd and force them back onto the sidewalk so the parade could proceed.
Describe it for us, because you mentioned the pageantry and the detail that went into the costume and the design, but tell us what it looked like.
Well, there were all these floats that represented nations that already had suffrage. There were all-female marching bands. There was an exact replica of the Liberty Bell. There were women marching by profession, working women, and they all had matching costumes. So all the nurses were wearing one thing and all the teachers were wearing one thing. The writers, by the way, purposely stained their costumes with ink. And then it was all meant to time perfectly to end at the steps of the U.S. Treasury building on 15th Street, which has a broad marble plaza in front of it. And there was going to be this very beautiful pageant on the Treasury steps of Columbia summoning the virtues. And there were children in togas and there were live doves and there were balloons. And it was a whole scene. And of course, the timing didn't work at all because the parade took so long to get down Pennsylvania Avenue. The pageant was long over by the time they made it those 15 blocks. So nothing went as planned.
Amazing photos in this book, by the way. Suffragists is the book, and Suffragist in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Boggs Roberts is the author and talking with me now about it. What kind of coverage is it getting? What kind of press coverage is it getting?
The parade?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was amazing, breathless coverage leading up to the parade. And one of the things that is endearing and also frustrating doing 20th century historical research is how sexist the press coverage is. Mm-hmm. So they kept talking about how pretty the women were and playing up rivalries between the pro-suffrage and anti-suffrage forces, some of which were completely invented. And so it was in the papers quite a lot leading up to the parade. And then, you know, the next day, the headline should have been Woodrow Wilson inaugurated as the nation's new president. But because the crowd had behaved so badly and because there was a near riot, the press coverage remained about the parade for weeks. There was a congressional hearing. Everybody was looking into why the police didn't do their job. And Alice Paul recognized right away that a perfectly beautiful parade would have been in the news for a day. And a near riot was going to keep the suffrage cause in the news much, much longer. So she realized that the riot was the best thing that could have ever happened to them. And there's a headline that I love from the Chicago Tribune. There's a big editorial cartoon on the front page that says the nation's spotlight. And there's like wimpy little Woodrow Wilson thinking he's going to get the nation's spotlight. Yeah. And ta-da, suffragist right in front of him, stealing it from him right on the front page of what should have been his day.
Well, I mean, you know, the bespectacled intellectual could not be a better foil for that kind of a movement. So, you know, great optics in that moment.
You say bespectacled intellectual. I say pencil-necked weenie. I mean, he really emerges as the villain of the piece. Yeah.
But tell us now about this movement, because you say it took a turn, a more radical, a more militant turn in some ways, or at least a more urgent turn than it had in its more plodding way up until then. But that didn't mean that everybody was on board. The suffragist movement was in some ways riven by this debate over militancy, right?
Very much so. The mainstream suffrage organization, the National American Woman Suffrage Association, led by Carrie Chapman Catt, was pursuing this state-by-state strategy, which wasn't crazy. I mean, the idea was that if enough states enfranchised women, then a federal amendment would be inevitable because the members of Congress would vote it in themselves to please their constituents. But that takes a really long time, and you need an organization in every state around the country. So there was the strategic difference with Alice Paul's group pushing for a federal amendment instead. But also, Carrie Chapman Catt was very wary of Paul's connection to the Pankhursts and thought that she would undermine the cause if she got too radical in her tactics. And she had right to worry about that. When Alice Paul finally split from the main organization and formed the National Women's Party, which still exists, by the way, she did start picketing the White House and burning the president's words in a bonfire on the White House grounds, and things that the mainstream national organization found distasteful and even destructive. And neither could have succeeded without the other. We wouldn't have the 19th Amendment with just the slow and steady plotting, or maybe it would have taken another 50 years. And we wouldn't have had it with just the aggressive picketing and burning aspect as well.
So let's talk about the impact going forward. In the immediate aftermath, of course, it's covered in the press. But what are some of the longer term effects leading up to passage of the in 1920, passage of the amendment? What are some of the effects of this march on the movement itself and on ultimately the women's right to vote?
Well, it certainly got a whole new generation of women involved. You know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, the women we know as part of suffrage history, they started the movement in the 1840s. They were dead by 1913. So it brought a whole new generation of activists into the movement. It got young women thinking that there was something more aggressive that they could do that was more direct action. And then, of course, when World War I happened, because that's the overarching context to the last couple of years of the suffrage fight, it had, you know, forced a lot of women into the public eye in roles that they were taking over from men who were at war. And so it all kind of blended together in this kind of progressive era, you know, women more in the public sphere, women demanding their rights, women wanting to be recognized as partners. All of those social movements kind of coalesce.
And it foreshadows in a lot of ways the geopolitical events of the time foreshadow what would be the civil rights movement in the center in the middle of the 20th century, where the hypocrisy of an America fighting for democracy, when it doesn't even offer democracy for all of its citizens, became a rallying cry.
And that was why that was another split in the suffrage movement. The more traditional group was very involved in World War I work and volunteer work. And Alice Paul's group kept picketing the White House while we were at war, criticizing the president during wartime, which some people really saw as traitorous. But they were so angered by this naked hypocrisy of Woodrow Wilson being the poster child for democracy abroad while ignoring the fact that half of his own citizens were disenfranchised. And you're absolutely right. That sets up this precedent of saying, actually, we need to hold our own leaders accountable for what they're doing here at home, no matter what it is they're saying into open microphones abroad. And even contemporary movements. I mean, those picket signs that they held in front of the White House in 1917, those are tweets, right? I mean, those are provocative statements meant to get a national audience paying attention.
I certainly want to fast forward to see how you think things are today, but I want to take a deep drop back to a movement that really begins in the early 19th century with the Seneca Falls statements all of those on suffrage, but even the temperance movement. In some ways, women had been taking charge and understanding the crisis that the American family was in owing to alcoholism, domestic abuse. You take Margaret Sanger's movement for Planned Parenthood and all these issues around families that really helped coalesce a suffragist movement that ultimately, you know, recognized that, hey, if we want to get change here, we need to have standing in the society, right?
And a lot of women came to the suffrage cause through temperance and abolition, but they felt that they would not get those causes taken care of in their favor unless they were granted the right to vote. So voting was actually sort of a secondary right that they wanted in order to affect these causes.
And it was useful
for the suffrage movement to be associated with abolition and temperance at the beginning because it gave them a crash course in field organizing and fundraising and stump speeches and all the stuff they needed to know.
So where are we today? What's the line? What's the genealogy between that movement and that ultimate success and where we are today?
I mean, there are a lot of parallels, of course, when you look at the marches and even the pink hats, you know, the sort of thematic costumes. And there are a lot of differences. The 1913 parade was led by a banner with a one-sentence demand on it. We demand a constitutional amendment. I'll say that again. We demand a constitutional amendment enfranchising women. One sentence, one very, very clear goal. And the contemporary women's movement has a lot of goals. And in some ways, that's the evolution. You know, we've gotten to the point where we can ask for more than one thing. But the parallels make it a little bit harder to see where does the current movement have actionable items in the same way that the suffrage movement did.
But the organization, I mean, I wonder about that aspect of it, the fact that it has become at least there is a central organizing principle, even though there are multiple principles or multiple goals. The ability to organize and the incentive to organize seems to be much more powerful today than it was even a decade ago.
And the confidence in the rightness of your own cause and the confidence that you are the person to speak for that cause. I think we owe all of that to the women who came before us in the suffrage movement.
You have some women who came before you who made a significant contribution, beginning with your grandmother, Lindy Boggs, who was the first woman in the state of Louisiana to be elected to Congress.
And she was born in 1916, before women had the vote. So the fact that she became a member of Congress and part of the Democratic leadership and then ultimately the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican is a testament to, in sort of general, the progress of women over the 20th century, but also to what an incredibly amazing person my grandmother was.
How much influence did she have on you? And we'll talk about your mother, who public radio listeners will know as Cokie Roberts, and their influence on you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty great matriarchal line, don't you think?
I would say so.
Have Cokie Roberts and Lindy Boggs.
Yeah.
My grandmother was a huge influence on me and continues to be by example. We lost her a few years ago, but I mean, every day that I strive to be a little bit more like Lindy Boggs is a day that I'm a better person. And my mother, Cokie Roberts, has, you know, forged so many new paths as a journalist and a working mother and set an example, but also been just such a cheerleader for my work and my successes. So it's wonderful to come from such a long line of strong women.
What was the biggest surprise for you in putting this book together?
I have to say how savvy Alice Paul was about all of it. And I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. Perhaps I underestimated her. But she was so good at figuring out how to get publicity, how to get often very sexist and anti-suffrage journalists to cover her movement in a way that even came out in a sympathetic manner. And how to turn every situation to her advantage, how to fundraise, how to choose the right stump speakers. She just was incredibly impressive. I'm not sure I would have wanted to sit down to dinner with her. There's no evidence she had a sense of humor whatsoever, but she certainly was an impressive lady.
Rebecca Roberts is the author of Suffragists in Washington, D.C., The 1913 Parade and the Fight for the Vote, also program coordinator for Smithsonian Associates. Rebecca, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca's going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh this Friday, March 16th, for a book reading and signing. And, of course, we have those details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, how we can teach children fundamental knowledge like colors in a culturally conscious way. Stay tuned.